Into the final moments, Alex Payne trying to keep this side going forward. Haskell takes it on now with just relentless chat, largely about himself. And there's Tyndall to add the finishing touch of glamour and World Cup winning stories and a slightly sideways nose. That is how you podcast. A dominant display by the good, the bad and the rugby.
Hello, everybody. And first things first, a very happy new year to you. Welcome along to the good, the bad and the rugby. A new dawn is upon us. And we've got a bit of a New Year tradition, actually. Somewhere and something and somehow we managed to get on an All Black legend at the start of each year. Last year it was Richie McCaw, and now we have a stellar name for you again in 2023. It's a man who has won the World Cup twice, a four-time Super Rugby champion, the second most capped All Black of all time and still going, a crusader, All Black skipper, brother, father, husband and farmer, which is an interesting way to round that off, the one and only Sam Whitelock. Happy New Year to you. How are you? And very nice of you to be joining us.
All good. Happy New Year, and it's good to catch up with some familiar faces that I don't get to see a lot, but always good fun when I do get to catch up.
We were nattering away just before we pressed record on this, and you were just recounting about the time you first met the Big Bear alongside. Can you just share with everybody where, I mean, no one ever forgets their first meeting with Hask, but yours included what?
Yeah, mine was no different to everyone else that first gets to meet Hask, and mine was in France. I was just made the team for the first year, played a few games and kind of got the old, hey, you're going on a promotion for Adidas after this, after the end of your tour. And so I think it was Mills, DC, Richie, Conrad and myself. And, you know, I was the young kid that just didn't want to make any mistakes. So I did as I was told and all those things. I rock up to a promo and Hass is there and he's dressed all in pink and pink boots and comes straight up to me and I'm just like, wow, this is different. Absolutely blew me away, and I had a few drinks that night because we were on our break, and I think Hass had training the next day, so it was a good night.
You never disappoint.
Well, it's interesting, Sam. I know you listen to some of the pod, like some of the stuff we do, but everyone we've always had on has always said, I met Hask. Well, before I met him, I wanted to punch him in the face. Then I met him, and I still kind of wanted to punch him in the face. And then afterwards, I was okay. I mean, was that similar or a similar experience?
Yeah, maybe just a different order, though, like when you're at the Landers, typical Landers stuff. So, yeah, it's there somewhere.
Somewhere. But do you know what the other thing was? At the time, the All Blacks were sponsored by, do you remember that boat company, that amphibious boat company?
Sea Legs, yep.
Yeah, Sea Legs. So Sea Legs basically had these inflatable ribs that they can also drive on the road. So I remember we did this promo with the All Blacks guys.
You must have been in your a competition winner.
I was, because a lot of what they don't all realise, obviously, like, you know, Sam's one incredible player, Rich McCaw's incredible player, all these guys. So even though I don't make out I'm a rugby nerd, I am a bit of a nerd, and I always appreciate who I'm with, but I can't get over the fact I'm a massive gobshite. He talks a lot, and I just can't dispel my normal personality or put it under wraps. So I was in there, I was like, oh my god, I'm with all the All Blacks, and they had these boats, we're driving through the heart on the Champs-Elysees in rubber dinghies, drinking out of Coronas out of a thing or whatever we were drinking at the time, and got back to the hotel. Graham Henry's there, he's like, Mr. Hask, what the fuck are you doing here? I was like, oh my god, it's Graham Henry, and he knows my name, and he's told me, what the fuck am I doing? And it was like really exciting. We got smashed up and I had to go to train the next day, which was pretty awful, but it was just great to meet the guys, because again, you know, especially when we'll talk about the mythology of the All Blacks, but you just don't get to operate with them very often. Because normally when they come over here, you know, say for example, it's on the last night of the tour stuff, they're often flying home the next day. Yes, you can go out and have a night out, but it's very hard to do that. And you know what I noticed about being in kind of New Zealand when I played was that after a game, the Highlanders guys would go in with the Crusaders and have a beer. You know, it doesn't really done over here, and you don't really get to do that on the international scene too much. So it's actually nice to spend a bit of time with the guys and see what they're like and make them tick. Because I also, do you remember I turned up in 2015 in that nightclub? After they won.
Yeah, I was probably a little bit hazy then. Probably the wrong person to ask you about that.
But the afterglow of winning the thing.
Well, because it was. I'm sure you would have been there somewhere, mate. Yeah, you always seem to come out when you least expected or least wanted.
I would work.
I was definitely least wanted in there. I was like, they said to me, "Do you want to come to?" It was actually platinum lace. Yeah. No, there was no strippers in there, which was a first disappointment. I'd also brought Chloe with me, so it's a bit like bringing sand to the seaside. What's the fucking point? But I turned up there, and all the All Blacks guys were there, and I was supposed to DJ. The guys asked me to DJ, and it quickly became clear that you know, my brand of music was not going to go down here. It was utterly pointless. I was basically gate crashing a World Cup winners party. And I was like, yeah, I'm probably just going to get... Chloe got really drunk. I got drunk and we just went home. Didn't DJ, didn't do anything. But it's very awkward. But, yeah. You know, good serum.
Ever the gift that keeps on giving. Do you know what I'm going to do, actually, Sam? I'm just going to break the sort of trade secret. So obviously, this is our New Year's show, but we're recording this not long after you've got back to New Zealand off the back of your end of year tour. Just tell us, how are you, first of all? You're still suffering with jet lag. You've got three minis, three on one overlap. Tell us how you are in real life at the moment, off the back of obviously what's been an extraordinary year as, you know, finishing up as a skipper of the All Blacks.
Yeah, I just heard the youngest one and my wife get home from dropping the other two at school in kindy, so the door is open, but I might have to slam that shut in a minute. But myself personally, now I'm pretty good. You know, a few bumps and bruises that always heal. But we had a big long trip on the way home, so it took us about 43, 45 hours to get home. We had a night in Monaco with the awards with yourself and then got home. We've, you know, been home a couple of days now, so just kind of rocking and rolling. My lovely wife said to me, or texted me when I was, you know, after the last game, hey, you're on holiday at the moment, you're going to get home and do some real work. So just in the middle of rocking and rolling with the kids, and you know, they've pretty much followed me around like little lost sheep. So yeah, it's good. It's different.
How old are your minis?
So I got three. Fred's five, Iris is three, and Penelope's one. So
wow,
right in the darkness at the moment.
You are in the tunnel. And tell me a little bit about what you've got. I mean, are you proper downtime now, and how long have you got, and what are you going to do to sort of to enjoy yourself over the next few weeks and months?
Yeah, so we're off now for a few weeks, which is bloody good. Nice just to be able to stop and say to the kids on the weekend, hey, what do you want to do? And just go do what they want. But back pretty much, I think we had a fitness test on the 23rd of Jan. So, yeah, everyone goes, oh, you got heaps of this time off, but you got to get fit because we'll get flogged during that fitness test, strength testing, all that stuff. And then a couple of days after that, back into Super Rugby, and you know, it's a big year coming, as everyone knows.
It certainly is.
Surely a man of your stature and experience can just have a little word going, listen, you know, I'll be fit, take it easy, or no, that doesn't work.
I'd like to say that works, but, you know, you can get away with that one fitness test, but it comes down to your performance. And if you're not fit, you're not ready to go. And, you know, it just shows we've got some great players in the team. Obviously, Brody, Scott's been playing awesome. And some of the young guys are going really good too. So you can probably try that once, but you can't do that a World Cup year.
Are you somebody that maintains it all the way through to the 23rd of January, or do you go as hard and get as fat as you possibly can over the next few weeks? several turkeys, barbecues every day, lying in the sun, or are you someone who just has to keep the engine ticking? I can hear a mini.
A bit of both, really. Like, my daughter's just yelling.
It's okay, it's very welcome. It's come one, come all. She's very welcome.
Yeah, no, she's all right.
No, do you know why? Because you don't have to worry about it, because you think that could be we have a level of professionalism. Whenever Mike Tindall's on, you just hear screaming kids.
Yeah.
Every time we have a business conference call, he's playing golf or screaming kids. I wouldn't worry about it. Honestly, just adds a bit of character to the whole thing.
You're not far behind as well.
Oh, big time. Yeah, I actually had to take my daughter Penelope to a meeting the other day at Crusaders when I got back, and it was quite funny. You're sitting there, you got, you know, the coaches and that there and all the, you know, the board and all that stuff. And I'm like, I just got to nip out and change the nappy. And then she's freaking got food all over me and I'm trying to pretend that I'm listening and engaged. And then I've just got to, like, I've got to go. I've got to get this one out of here. So it's actually quite nice for everyone to realise we are parents as well. We still do all those things and we're normal. Yeah.
I can only imagine what Colin Pinetree Meads would have made of nappy changing during a meeting from the All Black captain. But tell me a little bit about how you will actually get away from the sport, how important it is for you to get a proper few weeks away. Do you like to get on the river and fish? Do you go beach? What do you try and get done over the next few weeks?
So for me, I grew up on a family farm. So mum and dad are dairy farmers. So for me, getting out, going hunting, going fishing, and actually getting out of the city is the big one. So I always find it interesting on the Northern Tour. You know, there's people everywhere, you know, living in a hotel, you know, Miller, Scotland. You walk out the door at any time of the day and there's just people everywhere. So for me, it's actually getting away, and whether it's hunting, fishing, and actually just going off grid for a little bit. Nice to be able to turn your phone off and just be present, be where you are. So the kids are a good leveler for that too. You can't really chill out too much with them, but you can just take them somewhere and have an experience with the family. And it's totally different. You know, when I first started playing, you know, meeting Hass and that, it was all about, right, where's New Year's? When are going to fit a few beers in here and there? Where now it's totally different. I don't think I've seen New Year's in for a few years because the next day the kids are up early and it hurts too much now.
Early to bed.
I've got a quick question. One of the things I'm always fascinated about is with you guys, and in particular, you know, the amount of games you've played and the way you play the game in one of the most attritional positions, it's insane that you're still operating. And actually, when we had a photograph pitch side and I had Rich McCaw, Jerome Kano, Conrad Smith, Dan Carter, me, and Alex, and every single one of the retired players looks better than I mean, it's not hard to look better than me, but they seemed more able-bodied. Richie's running around. You know what he was like as a player. What's the secret to your longevity? Is it you were sensible in this downtime? Do you reinvest back in yourself with like physio, ice baths? Are you sacrificing virgins in the top field and drinking their blood? What is it you're doing to stay as fit and as healthy as you are, especially as a second row?
Yeah, it's a tough one. You know, really privileged with the way my career's gone so far, and I've had some amazing people that have helped me along the way. Like all those guys you've talked about have passed on knowledge, whether that's on the field or off the field. But the one thing that probably sums it up in my mind is, you know, how I started. So being this young guy rocking up, playing alongside Brad Thorne. So Thorny, you know, used to grab your shoulder, big hands, and start laughing. Oh, come with me, boy. And, you know, he actually showed me how to be professional, showed me how to stretch, ice bath, look after my body. And he always said, for him, he used to always look at the gym as an opportunity to grow your body, grow your defences, grow your big shields. And like, I remember, you know, I was 21, 22, getting beaten up every game, where he's like, I feel great because he had these defences. And it shows from my first game, I was 106 kgs, where the heaviest I've been is 124. So that is all pretty much just muscle and defences and shields. And that's probably why, touch wood, I've been lucky to play a long time.
How much are you enjoying it all at the moment? I mean, you have been there, you've done it, you've got every T-shirt that there is to get in the game. What keeps you driving?
Yeah, I still enjoy it. And I think anyone that's played rugby to a high level knows that if you're not enjoying it, you're not going to put your head in that dark spot and stop a defensive maul or make all these tackles and all that, because it does hurt. It is hard. But the enjoyment side of it has changed. So when you're younger, you know, yeah, we all want to go out and score 100 tries, and I haven't scored many, so that's definitely not me. But actually seeing some of the development of some of the younger guys, Simisoni, for example, like his year's been awesome, and you hope that some of the little conversations you have with him is actually making him better and grow and evolve, because that's actually one of the ways you get a lot of respect from the other guys, is actually helping people out versus it all being about you.
Seems like there is quite a big culture of that in the All Blacks, and especially at the Crusaders, from what we learned from Dan and from Richie talking about that kind of putting your arm around someone. You know, Brad Thorne, again, you know, I've heard that a million times about him, that he's an absolute legend, one of the most professional people in the world. I know he didn't suffer like young players or fools easily. Like apparently him and Ben Franks, just real negativity sitting in the corner, just like rolling their eyes and tutting and stuff like that. Do you pick up some of that kind of that old school mentality, but are still happy to help those who are prepared to work, or are you a bit nicer?
Yeah, the old school mentality is probably still in me. I perhaps got taught how to play the game through my father, and he definitely was an old school player. The first time I met Joe Smith, actually, Joe and Dad played a lot of club rugby in New Zealand together. You know, we played Ireland in 2012 or whatever it was, went up to Joe and shook his hand and said, hey, I'm Braden's son. And he goes, oh, I know exactly who you are. And straight away he goes, oh, let me tell a story about your father. And I said, oh, this will be interesting. He goes, well, he's the only player I was ever scared of. I was like, oh, you know, it's a good thing or a bad thing. He goes, but he was on my own team. So, like, Dad kind of grew up in that era of the thug and all that stuff. But that's the way it was. So I probably got a little bit of that in me, but you can't do much now. Like, probably at the start of my career, what we got away with, now you're looking at a long time on the sideline through suspension, red cards. But it doesn't mean you can't play hard and physical. So there is that element probably of my game to a point. Not saying I'm a dirty player, but it's there to a point.
I'm going to ask you about this, because obviously I've got the members of your family who've played top flight rugby in front of me, but will you just expand on it? Because it's not just your dad, obviously your brothers, your grandfather, your cousin, etc. It's a hell of a lineage. So we talk about the Barretts and what they've got, but the Whitelocks is a heck of a generation as well. Take me through all those in your family who you know have played top flight rugby.
Yeah, it's that question does come up every now and again, and you kind of give it the old, oh, you know, there's four boys and we've all been lucky enough to play for New Zealand, and you kind of just leave it there. But people like yourself, you've obviously done your homework, so I'll give you the whole rundown. So four boys, George played for the All Blacks, one test, scored in his first test, or his only test against Italy in Christchurch. Adam played for New Zealand Sevens, a couple of tournaments. Myself, little brother Luke, was the first of the family to captain the All Blacks, which definitely grates me a bit. He played seven or eight test matches, roughly. Probably my favourite test was when we got to play together for the first time in Wales, which I think was my 96th cap. Yeah, so awesome to play with him. Dad played for New Zealand Colts, played for Manawatu. Granddad, so mum's father, played for the All Blacks in 53-54. Mum's uncle played for the All Blacks in the same, Alan Nelson. And then mum's sister, Aunty Jo, married Graham Higginson, who was an All Black. And then, who am I missing?
Don't forget him, we get told off.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, if I forget someone, I'm in trouble. So, younger cousin, Ben, played 90-odd games for the Crusaders in Canterbury. Hamish Dalzell was played professionally all around the world. Long story short, Will Jordan and I actually share cousins, but we're not actually cousins blood-wise, but call each other cousins, so he can be thrown in there. and then on my wife's side, my wife's, I think it's great-great-great-great-grandfather played in 1905. He played one test match, then captain the first New Zealand League side. So my poor kids have one line to go, and they've got a bit of things to keep up.
Jesus.
But then my sister-in-law, Kayla, played 250 games for New Zealand hockey and was pretty much voted top 5 or 10 in the world for about 10 years straight. So there's a bit of sporting stuff in the background. Mum played tennis for the South Island.
And it's only an hour show, so. Played
netball as well. So, yeah, like I said, I kind of give that short answer to most people, but if you want the whole thing, that's
about it. No, we want the whole thing. Here, so.
That is unbelievable. Yeah. I can't work out whether New Zealand's a small place or whether that is a hell of a bloodline that you've got going right there.
Or you related to everyone
or
there.
Or you related to everyone yeah. in the country. And what I'd love to know is when you talk about all of the, you know, the credentials that you've mentioned there, who gets to sit at the top of the table come Christmas lunch? Does 143 tests and current All Black captain get you the head? Or have you got other people who you have to bow to?
No, I think that's the issue, the best thing about all of it. Like, I don't tell many people all that history, and you know, you're probably the first or second media thing that I've actually opened up and gave you the whole rundown. But with all of it, it's actually really good, because if anyone puts their head out too much, everyone else jumps on them straight away. So it actually keeps you really humble and that drive to be successful and better while you're still playing. So it is nice, but Dad definitely sits at the head of the table at home. And, you know, with us four boys, there was always an order. So it'd be Dad at the top, and then Mum to the side, then the little brother Luke. And then I was on the far end. So that's why I was always the skinny, tall kid, because the brothers never passed down the food. And then Adam, then George. So even, you know, when we kind of got to that age of bringing girlfriends home and then turn into fiancés and wives and all those things, it was always like that wife would kind of sit where we would too. And it was always weird when they sit in a different seat and you're kind of like, that's not your seat. You've got to come down here. And so it's just one of those weird things that families do. But yeah, it's one of the weird things that we do.
Because when I played there, they said that the Whitelocks were a bit like a hydra. If you cut one head off, two of them just appeared. Because honestly, I remember the first time I looked at the team sheet with Chris, I was like, fucking hell, how many Whitelocks are they? And then I'd find out there'd be one, and there was another one. I was like, they can't all be good at rugby. I mean, what?
Did you ever all play together for anything?
Yeah, no, we played all for the Crusaders. There's a couple of games that all four of us started, and my little cousin Ben, who played hooker. We played against, I think it was the Stormers and the Bulls, and it was a little bit freaky, eh? Like, I remember Grandad just being so proud, but you're looking around, you're going, oh, there's a brother, there's a cousin. And shit, this is just like backyard at home, but totally, totally different. We used to break a few people too. Like, I remember Ryan Crotty sat in front of us on one plane. It was like the three seats, and then he was in front, and we're just like annoying him, and we had him broken within about 30 seconds because he just knew it was never going to stop, and he just had to give it the, can you please leave me alone? Yeah, we kind of just keep winding him up.
Do you get on? Are you competitive? Because it was interesting when we spoke to Kieran Reid. You know, he said about his kind of his brothers and his family playing in the backyard. You know, obviously when we talk to Kiwis and talk to All Blacks players, you know, because the national sport is rugby over there, that's the first thing that everybody wants to do. Were you super competitive? Were you out in the backyard with your brothers playing touch till your mum's calling you in? Were you going mad? Were you fighting all the time? What was it like?
Yeah, it was exactly that. You should probably get mum and dad on this to give you the real goss, but there are stories, apparently rumours, there might be a bit of truth behind it, of us locking out babysitters and mum and dad coming home and the babysitter sitting on the back door just in tears crying, and we're running around the house just like we've won lotto, you know. I remember one time the babysitter goes, put on a jersey. So we're going to put on every jersey we had and like take it off. So you got to take them all off and just those niggly little things kids do. So yeah, we weren't little angels, we'll say, but there's four of us, but there's only 5 years between all of us. So George being the oldest, he could get along with Luke really well. And, you know, even now with weddings and friends and that, it doesn't actually matter who it is. You kind of, if you're friends with one of us, you end up with all of us. And that was always the mentality. Dad used to almost tell us off more when we got into trouble by ourselves, because he's like, you know, you're not looking out for your brother, you're not making sure he's all right. So that was almost the worst punishment, when one of the brothers went and did something and you didn't do it, so you'd still get punished. So it was like, okay, if we're going to be naughty, we'll all be naughty and do it together. But I think that's why now we get along so well. Like, yeah, we scrap when we're little kids, as all brothers do, but now we get along so well, and all our wives get along, and the nieces and nephews are growing pretty quickly. So it's just history repeating again. But there's only four of us, where there's eight Barretts, so I'd hate to know what that household is like.
There's eight Barretts?
Yeah. You could almost have an All Black team entirely made up of Whitelocks and Barretts.
Oh, my God, I didn't know. Yeah. Are the other ones any good or not?
Yeah, so five boys and a couple of girls. So the two boys that didn't play, I think Blake's playing for the local club. I think he's been captain for a bit. He goes pretty good as a seven. And then Kane, I played with him at university a little bit down here, and he went pretty good, but had to retire through concussion and stuff like that. So, yeah, they're all pretty handy. They all know their way around a sporting field.
That's a big barbecue as well when the time comes.
You guys in New Zealand need to get other hobbies apart from having kids, like, you know, like
long cold nights.
Yes, about
long
so, cold yeah. nights. Too much cuddling up. Yeah. Jesus.
What I was going to ask you, Sam, is was it always rugby for you? Or, I mean, Kieran Reid obviously was a brilliant cricketer, et cetera, et cetera. Were you always into rugby, or was it basketball, tennis, swimming? I don't know. Other opportunities?
I gave cricket a go for a couple of years. So Aaron Smith and I went to the same high school, so known each other since 13. And Aaron is very good at cricket, and he's like, mate, come play cricket, come play cricket. I couldn't bat, I couldn't bowl, but he loved me standing at point, just big mitts, trying to catch everything. So I kind of gave that a go for a year, but then I really fell in love with basketball, and this kind of sums up how terrible it was at the start. The first layup I ever tried to do is I bounced the ball, pretty much hit my feet or whatever, and I rolled the ball off the backboard, but instead of it going into the hoop, it's bounced off the backboard and pretty much landed on halfway. So coordination wasn't the best thing. And then to rub salt into the wound, for the next 4 years, I got most improved player. So I must have been terrible at the start. And the only reason I didn't get in my fifth year is because my little brother started playing, and he was a little bit like me, bit gumby, bit uncoordinated. And then he took that mantle. So that was definitely the game that wasn't the family game, but it was the game that Luke and I fell in love with, and just obviously with a bit of height definitely helps, but it's what our mates were doing, and that was the thing that kind of stopped me getting in trouble at school, because I was probably a little bit naughty at third and fourth form, and just allowed me to express myself and burn a bit of energy off.
Have you got an NBA team out of interest?
Yeah, San Antonio Spurs. So when I was playing, Tim Duncan was the man, and still is in my mind. So he was the guy that I tried to copy some of his moves, not very well, but he's one of those superstars in my mind that people don't really know about. He's that superstar that's kind of hit in the open and just gone about his work, plays for a small team. But when you actually look at what he's achieved, is pretty amazing.
So therefore, I'm obviously trying other things, but at what point did you kind of get the tap on your shoulder in a rugby context and someone say, look, hang on, obviously, you know, you've got pedigree in the family here, but you've got what it takes to become or to go all the way here? Do you remember the early conversations about potential and focus, etc.?
Yeah, there definitely was a moment in my mind I went, hang on, this actually could be an option. I might have been third or fourth form, and I overheard one of the first 15 coaches talking to another teacher. I don't know if he knew I was listening or not. I kind of walked behind him, and he goes, you know, Samuel will play a heap of rugby and he'll play a number of test matches. I'm like, hang on, is he... He's talking about me. it was just that little moment that I needed, because coming from a rural town, and at this stage I didn't really know the family history of sport and all those things, but didn't understand that, hey, why not me? Why can't I go on and play for Manawatu two, or you know, maybe make Super Rugby, or even have an opportunity to play for the All Blacks? And that was actually what I needed. I just needed that little moment to go, if this guy thinks I can, why not? And that was our hostel manager at the time, and he was massive on setting goals. And he used to make us, like, before first 15 game, get up there and read out your three goals for the game. So I thought I was a loose forward at that stage. So you'd get up and go, oh, I want to get three turnovers in a game. And you'd say it to your mates and your peers. So all of a sudden, you kind of got to go out there and do it. If you're saying one thing and not doing it, you're looking like a bit of an idiot. So that's kind of where it all started. And then it just grew and evolved from there. And where I am now, like, I think of my career, like when I first started playing for All Blacks, no one had played 100 test matches. So all these guys have gone before and broken these barriers, and then all of a sudden that same mindset of, well, if they can do it, why not me? You know, it's not something you say all the time, but it's just in the back of your head, it kind of gets you spinning. And that's where, like, my older brothers, they obviously paved the way for me making some of those teams, missing out on some of those teams, to actually go, look, you know, I'm 5 metres down the hallway, so why not me?
Yeah. I mean, I always love hearing where these stories start, because, I mean, you know, injury permitting and et cetera, you will become the most capped player in the men's side of the game of all time next year, which is just an extraordinary thing, as you say. You know, there are so many people breaking this 100-test barrier, but you'll hopefully, God willing, break 150. But do you remember the first days of stepping into the environments like the Crusaders and the All Blacks? Did it feel a very natural progression for you, or do you remember thinking, holy Moses, this is another level?
Yeah, it definitely was that. And I was always lucky enough, because of my height, you know, say if I was playing under 15s, the second 15 wanted, hey, can you come play, or whatever it was. And that's where I kind of always played up a level, up an age group or a weight size or whatever it was. And that was just because my brothers were older than me. I should get Dad on here, like, he'll give you all the stories. But pretty much when I was three, and you imagine Dad telling the story versus me, so I'm going to hold a few things back. But he reckons he used to hang on to me. So the older two brothers were playing under fives, touch rugby. And then Dad would get sick of hanging on to me, and then he'd let me go. So I'd be out there playing with them, and the older brothers were fast. So they'd get there, get touched over the line, pass me the ball, and I'd score. So I thought that was awesome. But then after scoring a couple of tries, I'd get bored and I'd go jump in a puddle, or I'd go, like, Dad reckons I would be chasing butterflies or doing cartwheels or doing the old fart under the arm.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of like how it all happened. And for me, when I made Canterbury, I stepped into a Canterbury side with two brothers. I stepped into the Crusader side with two brothers. My brother had played for the All Blacks the year before I was selected. So They had just been the trailblazers and just gone, hey, we'll break all these barriers. And for me, sitting there was like, right, this is awesome. If they can do it, I can too. And I still remember when Todd Blackett rang us to say that, hey, you're going to be in the Crusaders this year. We're at the Christchurch races, because it was we're there for whatever reason, having a few drinks and a good time. And we're all together. And George answered the phone, and you know, you could see that he just had to sober up a little bit. Like, that's cool. Then he passed the phone to Adam, then Adam passed the phone to me. So Toddy rang George, but we all found out within the space of 10 seconds together. So that's something that, you know, is as a family that you can never replace, because we got to do our dream, or we got to, you know, achieve some of those things together, which was just, yeah, pretty cool, pretty amazing.
I imagine that afternoon didn't get any quieter at the races.
A lot of times when you walk into kind of different social situations and different teams, obviously you said your brothers kind of forged the pathway, but did you always feel like you had someone had your back in there? So you were kind of, yes, you're making your first impression, you wanted to earn your spurs, but you kind of had a bit of an insight, and that must have made it slightly easier, especially walking into the Crusaders team that you walked into with those, some of them names.
Yeah, like a lot of those guys, you didn't know at the time, but they were, you know, double checking some of your stuff, making sure that, you know, you missed the tackle, that they were there straight away, probably, you know, marking a little bit closer, so they're protecting you in different ways. And that's something that hopefully I'm doing now to help out some of the new guys, actually setting them up to succeed versus setting them up to fail. But that's where it doesn't matter what team you step into, whether it's your local club, whether it's international rugby, you've got those senior guys there to help and show you what you need. And sometimes it's actually voicing it, but other times it's actually letting you make those mistakes and learn those hard lessons. And, you know, ideally you step into those environments and you're ready to go. But, man, I was not ready to go. Like, I was fast and athletic, but I had no defences, man. I was skinny, I was raw, and, you know, after every game I was beaten up. So the biggest thing that they said to me was, right, go do weights. So they go, right, who's the best in the gym here? Owen Franks, Ben Franks, Thorny, go train with him. And they used to hate at me taking all the weights off and doing my reps, whatever, and then they put it all back on. But that's just what it was, and that's the best thing about, you know, people having your back, people being able to go, right, I'll help you. And, you know, I know Thorny used to always say, oh, how many test matches are you on? You're like, oh, 10 or whatever. He's like, you're on 2. The other 8 are mine. You know, they're all my test matches. And he's probably true. It's probably correct.
What is amazing, what I love these interviews, and I love these conversations, because you're so, as a collective, you're so down to earth, the Kiwis, and yet there's so much legacy and history around the All Blacks. So the first time you played for New Zealand, 2010, off the bench, 2 tries. Is that correct?
Yeah, it must have been seagulling, as some people would say in New Zealand.
Yeah, we do a little bit of that. We like to make sure that we got a bit of the detail and the glory where it's deserved. Just tell us about stepping into, as a kid, as you've mentioned here, you know, there's legacy in your family, there are brothers around you, etc. But the personal pride that you felt in stepping into that All Black environment and quite clearly taking to it like a duck to water.
Yeah, so my first All Black experience was actually going to... So I played club rugby in Christchurch, and I don't know why you remember these things, but the showers were broken and they were freezing. So I've just had a real quick wash, got on a plane to watch my brother play. So he had been selected on the bench against France in Wellington in 2009. And I remember getting to the stadium. Everyone was already in there. There was a security guy that would already plan, had my ticket, so I went straight in. Sat down just as the anthems were kind of being played, so I just made it in time. My brother didn't get on, but that was like my first experience with the All Blacks. The next week, George played in Christchurch, came off the bench. The next game I went to, I was on the bench. And it happened so quickly, in the space of 12 months, I was playing club rugby in New Zealand to then playing for the All Blacks. And I was like, this is, you know, probably too fast. Looking back now, I think of that. At the time, I was like, no, this is awesome. Let's get stuck in. But the best thing about it is I had people around me that were there to help. I roomed with Brad Thorn. I played with Brad through Super Rugby. But initially, I missed selection and then got a phone call because Ali Williams had done his Achilles. Tom Donnelly had a broken foot. And it was the old, hey, can you come up for 2 days and just train with the team? So I wasn't officially part of the team. It was just there as, you know, hold a hip pad or whatever. And then did enough. They're like, hey, we need you to come to New Plymouth to do the same. And then named on the bench. So it was actually the best way to do it. I didn't actually have time to stop and think and go, this is awesome. It's all happening. This is the dream that I've always wanted. And then we played Ireland and... there's a red card early, and I remember sitting on the bench going, oh, hey, this is good. Hopefully the game opens up. We start pumping them, and they'll put me on. And that's pretty much how it played out. And then got out there, and I just remember thinking, shit, this is getting real heavy real quick. And got into a scrum, free kick. They went early, went around the corner. I think Victor Vito carried, and then went around the corner, and Pity put me through a hole. And Anthony Borick went through the hole, gave it back to Pity. Pity gave it to me. I just had to catch the ball and fall over the line. So that was my first introduction to test match rugby, going, this can't be right. You know, I've just rocked up, scored a try. This is everything that I've always dreamed of. And it just shows that, like, all those people there to help out, and it made my job so easy.
Am I right in saying, so you scored 2 on your debut, and you've then scored 5 more in the ensuing 142 tests? Which makes me wonder what you've been doing.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was pretty pumped up after the game and had to do media. And the media guy's like, oh, is that the greatest test match either? I was like, mate, I've scored 2 tries. If I never score again, I'm happy. I don't know why I said it. I was excited. And then that was pretty much me. So
you've cursed yourself.
I've got to work for them now.
Do you do initiations or anything like that? Obviously, on the England team bus, you sing songs and things. Is there an integration, let's call it, when you become an All Black? Do you have to sing a song, tell a poem?
Nothing too major, and that's something that we got to experience in Wales. They had two new guys that played, and they sang, and then Wayne Barnes had played his refereed his 100th Test match. He got up there and started singing. Then I was speaking next, and I was sitting there, and obviously the room was hot. I just started sweating. Got up there, and everyone was chanting. All the All Blacks guys were going, song, song, song. And trust me, you don't want to hear me sing. That's not good for anyone. And I just had to admit straight away, I was like, sorry, guys, I'm sweating bullets here. I'm not going to sing. And everyone just booing at me. But now that's probably a northern thing, like singing a song. With the capping ceremony, it's pretty traditional around getting your cap and speaking and thanking people. And there's one thing that I must admit I forgot. My now lovely wife was standing there, and it was last, there's about 6 or 7 of us that played that first test match and thanked the coaches and my parents and all that, but I actually forgot to thank Hannah. So now whenever I do anything, the first thing I'm like, thanks to Hannah, take it off, and then I kind of say whatever I did, because
did you get some heat
she's
for that?
Never forgiven me for it.
Is she not?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, really?
Yeah, she's not coming down here, dipping in, so we'll just go past.
You've got 143 caps or whatever you got.
Two World Cup winners, terrified of her indoors.
Shit scared of your missus. I love it.
And she's only about this high too, so.
Oh, really? Do you know what? I didn't cry on our wedding day, and so my wife's never forgiven me for that. She basically says I was emotionally dead, and I cried when my daughter was born, and I didn't cry on wedding day. Honestly, they never forget, mate. They're like elephants times 10.
Yeah, they definitely know what the go is. So it's, yeah, you're buggered now for the rest of your life.
I know. I was going to ask, with that kind of, again, being a national sport and being kind of so much heritage, and actually because of your family involvement and all the kind of, again, the rich tapestry of All Black sort of heritage you have, just how magical was that moment? Because when I played over there, I just kind of, you really absorb that almost spirituality around the All Blacks. So just how magical was that, getting that shirt? And do you just feel such an obligation to that shirt more than anything else?
Yeah, it's something that as Kiwis, when we grow up, and you guys have heard this 100 times, but as early as I can remember, we've got family videos, and I should find some for you guys, but probably not making myself look good here, doing hakas, and that when we're, at 3, 4, 5, and losing your voice because you did it that many times. So when you do get an opportunity to do that, the haka, it better than anyone else. You can do it when you're tired, hungover, all those things. But the reality is to perform it the first time for the national team, that's probably the one thing that it was actually Ali Williams said to me. He goes, I was so nervous about the haka more than the game. And he said that to me before my first one. So straight away, I'm just thinking about the haka the whole time. I'm like, okay, left, right, whatever it is. And that is probably the thing that spiritually, and I'm not a very spiritual person, but that is probably the thing as an All Black, you go, that is the time that it just means so much because you've done it for the national side and you've done it home and away. And, the history with it, and it just kind of all hits you at different stages.
Can I ask you about some of the glory moments of your career, so to speak? So I'd love you to give us a comparison between 2011 and 2015. From the outside, it would appear that 2011 was relief and 2015 was ecstasy. Is that what it felt like, or is there a different nuance when you look back on those two now?
Yeah, there's kind of two ways that I look at it, and exactly that. So every media thing I did in 2011 is, hey, you're 23 years old, you haven't had it for 24, you haven't been alive when you're New Zealand being world champs. And it honestly, it came every single, I kind of got to a stage where they're like, yeah, no, thanks, guys. You keep reminding me of that. And, being a young guy, I really didn't have to front the media too much. But I didn't really know what it was. I'd never been to a World Cup. And after the final whistle in the change room afterwards, Andrew Hall was there having a sign, like looking at us, being on Frank's and myself. And he goes, you guys don't know what you've done. And we're like, what do you mean? He goes, you've never lost one, so you don't know what it's like to win one. And we're like, mate, this is awesome. And he goes, yeah, don't get me wrong, but some of the guys in the room, they've been to 2, 3 World Cups and have not been successful. So it was kind of one of those moments that I always held on to. And Horry being Horry, he just said it in his own way, said it direct, but what he said was actually spot on. And that's the thing that I really remember about 11. 15 was totally different. You know, I'd gone from 11 being the baby of the team to kind of growing up to being middle tier, I'll say. Had played a lot of rugby during that World Cup, and totally, totally different to the feeling of 11. And the main thing probably was actually being on the field with the final whistle, because in 2011, the game was tight, came off after Joseph Twa had just scored with pity, and I was just like everyone else in the stadium. I mean, I was a fan. I knew I couldn't scream. I couldn't help out the team in any way. I just had to watch. And that feeling was horrific, where at least in 15, I could actually do something. So whether it was talking the D-line, make a tackle, get up, I was actually in control because I could have an influence on the outcome. But in 2011, it was totally different because I was standing on the sideline as a fan, like all the other Kiwis, just chewing nails, and that was it. So that's the difference in the two. For me, because one, I was out there, the other, I was a fan.
Again, as well, for 2011, obviously, there was a devastating earthquake in Christchurch and stuff, and obviously I know you were in the kind of the mix for that, and that puts everything in perspective. How hard a period of time was that? Because, you know, obviously the Crusaders kind of got rehomed, you know, there might have been people that you knew lost, you saw sort of homes devastated, and then you have to, you know, perform and get into a World Cup. Can you just tell us about that period?
Yeah, 2011 was the year that kept on giving. So we had the earthquakes, which most people know, but in Christchurch, we lost our stadium. We lost a lot of people. We lost pretty much everything in the middle between it. So a lot of roads were no good, all the infrastructure pretty much buggered, and the whole city and region was put into a massive state of shock, and it took us a long time to get out of it. And we didn't play that game. We were meant to play, I think it was the Hurricanes, away, because it just wasn't the right thing to do. And then all of a sudden we were facing a massive year before the World Cup as Crusaders. We had a really good squad. We'd had a good 2010 and we were on the improve. Everyone was playing really well. And we faced playing a whole season with no home stadium in Christchurch. So we had a couple of games within our region, but every game was either bus or fly. We even played in Twickenham against the Sharks. And I think, I'll get these stats wrong, but I think we flied around the world three times for the season. And that was the thing that probably didn't help us in the end. Like, we had a really good semi-final against the Stormers, went back to play the Reds, and nothing against the Reds. They were a great side, and Quaid and Will just controlled their whole team and carved us up as they were for Australia at the time. But it felt like if we were at home, the result maybe could have been different. But we always said, you know, playing that season, if we get the job done, they'll make a movie on and all those things, but we didn't, so we never did. It was one of those things that we knew as players, we just had to go out there front, play well, because that's actually what the city and the region needed, especially after the World Cup games were lost to Christchurch and then were moved to Auckland and Dunedin, I think. So it was pretty tough for people that had suffered to then have a blow later.
Here's a big question for you. What is the secret to the Crusaders' success?
Yeah, I've been asked that a couple of times too.
Trade secrets, please.
I'd love to say it's this or it's that, but I think the main thing is actually the people. With that, it's the character of the people. And I go back to a story that I tell little kids sometimes, or, you know, people that are playing first 15 rugby and, you know, want to get better, is I overheard a conversation Corey Flynn had with two of the young hookers. One was Cody Taylor, one was Ben Fennell at the time. He goes to them, "Hey guys, I'll help you out in any way. You ask me to help you with your throwing, anything around positional, off field, whatever, just ask and I'll do it." But then the next breath he said, "But I'm not going to give you my jersey. It's your job to retire me." So I remember hearing that going, hang on, this guy's helping these guys retire him, you know, put him out of rugby and make him go somewhere else. And I thought about it for a long time, but the thing he was doing is he was A, making them better, he's making the team better, which was the thing that was underlying everything. But everything on top of that, he's actually challenging himself to grow his own game and be better than these younger guys. And he actually set them up to be very successful. Flinney had an amazing career too, and when he left, he knew the team was in a great spot. So then it was never going to fall over, because that's, for us as players, no matter what team we play for, we'd all hate to see our teams decline and go backwards. So I think that's probably one of the major things as a Crusader that I can see and look at. There's so many players that have done that for different people. You know, I had it myself, Brad Thorne, Isaac Ross, Chris Jack. I pretty much just tested them for all the information, and they were happily to give it up. So I just tried to take all their strengths and none of their weaknesses and involve my game. And then hopefully I'm doing the same for someone like a Scott Barrett. Obviously he's flying now. I don't need to worry about him. But some of these other guys, Mitch Duncher, Quinton Strange, some of these other young guys that are coming through the academy system, because the reality is they're going to put me into retirement, and that's a good thing because the team's in a better spot.
You can see why the mystique grows, can't you?
I'm interested by the kind of, how with the modern players, and you've probably noticed yourself from where you started to where players are now, how you maintain that, because it's useful to... You know, I know it's obviously with you there, you know, the legacy continues as the players continue. But how do you instill it in them? How do you kind of make people not so selfish and actually want to share? Because that's quite a rarity, especially in kind of the youth of today.
Yeah, that's a challenge that we're definitely facing at the moment. But if you go back to character of people, normally they're there to help. And is it you or is it the team? And sometimes that's the easy thing to ask someone and go, look, don't answer me now, just think about it. Are you here for yourself or here for the team? And, you know, we can all go out there and try and do everything yourself, but it's a contact sport. There's no point a tight head prop trying to splice and split the loose head and hooker out if his hooker doesn't have his back, because he's going to get popped out of the roof straight away. So I think that's where rugby as a sport, we're so lucky because it's physical and it's contact. You've got to have that connection. If you don't, It's a hard old day at the office.
Can I ask you about some of the layer above you, certainly an age group, that you came through by? So likes of Richie McCaw, Kieran Reid, Dan Carter, Sonny Bill, Mar Nonu, Comrade Smith, etc. I mean, give us a little sort of reflection on each of them and excuse me, what it was like being in the slipstream of some of the greatest players to have ever played the game.
Yeah, it's everything you'd imagine and more. Even just catching up with a few of those guys that I played with and some of the guys I played against at the awards, you know, it's still so humbling actually being able to stop and have a yarn to them and just be a fan. Sometimes that's actually what it was like, you know, whether it was DC cutting defence up as a lock, you might stand on halfway and go, okay, DC's going to run 40 here and score. He didn't, then all of a sudden you've got to get there. But it's actually really hard at times. You've got to be careful you don't stop and actually enjoy it as a fan. You go, okay, I've got to be there to clean the ruck. So then it goes wide and Jerome scores in the corner. But yeah, all those guys, good friends and all, helped me in such a way and helped me grow and evolve with my game. All those guys you've mentioned, got a great connection with all of them, whether it's on the field, whether it's, you know, our wives are close, kids are the same age. It's one of those things, whenever you travel with those guys who spend so much time in hotel rooms, playing cards, etc., I'd hate to know how many times Reid and I spent in a coffee shop playing 500, Euchre. White Crockett was a horrific cheater. Everyone knew he was cheating, but it was just so slow at playing. But you spend those times with them, so then all of a sudden pressure comes on. You know, okay, Luke Romano, when he's under pressure, does this, so you can help him out, and vice versa, because sometimes they're actually helping you out, reading your body language before you even know you're in that state yourself.
Very interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's such a collection of greats.
Yeah, I just love how cerebral that your process is, because you obviously talked about kind of the way you prepare for games. Like how much work do you put into that kind of mental stuff in regards to the body language? Because you're obviously very versed in it now, but that's, I think, quite unusual. A lot of players we interview don't necessarily talk about that. They talk about a bond and stuff, but they don't go into that depth. How much do you do that analysis, and how much stuff around your kind of the mental side of the game do you get into? Because I'm always fascinated by this.
Yeah, the mental side, this is how I had it explained to me, and I think this is still the best way to explain it, is if you got all the international sides up and put how heavy are they, how strong, how fast, skill level, systems, all those things, they're all pretty similar, aren't they?
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what side you pick. So where is the greatest growth? The greatest growth is on the mental side of the game, whether it's performing under pressure, whether it's your homework, your prep, your analysis. So that's something that all those guys you mentioned, all of them are very, very good at all those areas. So sometimes you got to witness, you know, DC at 10, reads the game really, really well, and you're going, oh, that's what he's looking at. Okay, so that's something that you pick up. How does that relate back to me? Don't ask me whether the space is on far left, because that's not my job. I'm looking at a line out. How do I read someone's body language? Is someone, you know, off balance because they're going to go forward and jump? So how do you use that against people? And it's just actually picking up some of those little tricks of the trade. And the best thing is when people tell stories, because those stories are actually just a way of learning. And I think all of our parents, and my father especially, learned this stuff after a game, having a beer at the pub. They talked all these things, where for us now in the professional era, we're on the plane going to the next location. We don't probably get that chance to socialise with our mates and actually just talk code, talk rugby, and talk the ins and outs of it. So that's something that we get to do at airports, which is a little bit different, but there is an opportunity there to grow and make yourself better.
Are there ways you keep trying to reinvent yourself in regards to those areas? Are there things like, you know, would you talk to a talk to a psychologist? Would you, you know, how much are you watching more footage than you've ever watched before? Or as you've got older and a lot of the stuff's become second nature, do you find it better to go into a game with a fresher head? Like, how are you getting, you know, where's the area of growth for you at the moment, do you think?
Yeah, I've kind of been full circle. I started out younger, not really knowing what to watch, so I didn't watch a lot. Probably watched it as a fan more than anything. Then got to a stage where we kind of worked out what to look at, probably obsessed over it too much, and probably actually slowed myself down because I had too much information. And then I've probably come around all the way around to watching what I need to, and then actually just trusting your instinct of actually going out there and doing it. 9 times out of 10, if you trust your gut, you're going to be right. And if not, it doesn't actually matter. You're just worrying about the next moment, the next task. And I think that's where rugby is one of those games that you've got to keep evolving. We do seem to change the rules all the time, whether it's a tweak or something dramatic. Whether you agree with that or not, it's an opportunity to get better and go, right, how do we use this rule? Where can we push the lines? Where can we push the boundaries? And that's where I look at the great players, the guys that have played over 10 years for whatever country. They've evolved, they've grown their game. Some of them started out as annoying number seven that was good over the ball, and then all of a sudden evolved his game to call a line out, to jump in the line out, ball carry defensively, making good decisions. So that's something as all of us, you know, if you're not evolving, you're going to be caught up real quick and people go past you, and then you're in the stand. So it's just the way I look at it. So hopefully I've got a few things to work on, and I know I do. So there's some good young players coming up.
Keeping on your toes. Can I ask you a couple of questions? I'd be really fascinated with your view on this, given what you've achieved in the game. But we've spent a lot of time talking recently about how competitive it now is at the top end of the game. Top 10 all beat each other week in, week out. We've got English rugby at the moment eating itself. We've got Welsh rugby going through something similar. You've obviously, as an All Black, had a bit of that this year with Ian Foster under enormous pressure midway through the Rugby Championship. And then a couple of weeks later, you're all lifting the trophy. Wait, when you look at international rugby now, what do you see? What are you experiencing in that landscape as a player?
Oh, you're spot on. Like, we've had an interesting year, we'll say. It's been up and down. We've had some really good performances. We've had some parts of games we've been really good. Other parts we've been less than average. Our last 9 minutes, a prime example of that. But I think if I look at it now, it's actually the same as what it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Any team can beat any team, and it doesn't actually matter who or what or where. It's actually you working out, okay, what do I have to do right now? And that's something that we talked about as a team and myself individually. Yeah, we haven't been playing that well. We might have lost the game or going through a bad patch, but what's actually the most important thing right now? Not worrying about everything else. And when you actually look at those things, what do I need to do right now? So for me, okay, work ethic, physicality, all those things, that comes first. Everything else is extra noise, all those things. And it's actually just doing your job. And I know that sounds really simple and basic, but that's actually where I think myself personally, I play better. And I think the team, we need to just simplify things down and just worry about what you've got to do. And that's what teams do well. Like, I think of all the great teams of the past, they actually do the simple things really, really well. They just do their job. So you got the front row nailing their role, the locks, back five, doing what they need to. The 10s and 9s are driving you around. The 12s are getting game line. The outsides are finishing. It's actually a really simple game when you look at it. And sometimes we probably overcomplicate it.
I love that answer.
It's true. I think you're exactly right. You know, if you go and execute what you're supposed to do and do your role, and you know that your role is done in the right way, and it's the correct way of doing things, then you're only going to help the team. And I wondered with, I know you wanted to ask another question, but I just, what's this period been like? Because, you know, I mean, I obviously was very lucky to play with Maro Nonu in Japan, and I think he'd lost 7 games out of 77 or something. Or something ridiculous like that. And I think there's other guys like, you know, Rich, he's got, you know, I think he'd only lost something, a ridiculous number of games. It was like such a minute detail because it's so unusual. How did you guys cope with it? Because it seemed like from the outside that when it got back on track, you guys had a real point to prove. But it looked like quite a bit of a dark period for you guys because it was so unusual. For, you know, in my career, I lost games all the fucking time. So what a problem. But for you guys, it's a bit of a rarity.
Yeah, it's something that doesn't matter. Win, loss, or draw, we always talk about you should review the game the same. So there's nothing worse than the old emotional roller coaster, playing really well, don't review the game, bang, have a loss or a performance you're not proud of, and then it just all of a sudden you're doing this through the season. So we just need to always be going up. And I think that's the easiest way to do it is you start with the senior players. Are they getting better? Are they growing their game? Are they demanding, you know, those things of themselves? And if they're doing that, then all of a sudden the team's in a good spot, because when the seniors are doing it, the next guys are doing it, the juniors are seeing it, they're evolving the game. When the senior guys are not being challenged, so whether that's from themselves, whether that's from, you know, the management, the coaches, etc., that's when you can potentially run into the emotional, hey, we lost, we're going to play really well, dip down, etc. So that's just how I personally look at it. And I know in the past, from looking at good teams, being involved in good teams, when the seniors are driving everything, it's real easy to get on board and get stuck in.
I just mean from an emotional point of view, because I think you're spot on with what you said, but just because it got pretty punchy over there in regards to the criticism of the coach, of the people, because, you know, the All Blacks normally lose a game and then they bounce back, but to lose 4 games or whatever it was, everyone was questioning everything. You know, people over here were like writing you off, you know, and that's just unheard of in my lifetime. And I just wondered, on the receiving end, were you panicking? Were you in your room marching up and down, like smashing stuff up, like, or did you just block out that noise, go back to everyone doing their role, start challenging each other and stick with it? Or was there a moment where you were like, fuck this is all over?
Like, the easiest way to sum it up is, what can you control? Like, you can't control social media, the comments, the scrolling. You know, like, they're there. That's people's opinions, all those things. The best advice I got given, and it was in 2011 when the pressure was on, because everyone was using the whole, hey, look, you haven't won it for 24 years, all these things. What happens if you lose at home? Will you ever win it? And we just turned it around and said, but what if we do? So we just took whatever their comments were and tried to turn it into a positive. And from that, the conversation flowed. It's probably showing my age here and a few greys, but the paper were just writing everything they wanted. And everyone said, don't read the paper. If you pick up the paper, look at the photos, then throw it away. And that's obviously harder now to do with social media, phones, internet. It's everywhere. So for me, it was actually really easy. Just don't go on it. Don't follow those shows or those people that are really opinionated. Actually just get away from it. So that's what I did, and that's what a number of the players have done. And actually going, okay, is this extra noise? Is this an emotional piece, or is this actually going to help me be better? Actually just focus on that. Easier said than done, because in New Zealand, it is a fishbowl. You walk down the street, if you ask the 10 people there, they'd all have a different opinion on who's playing well, who should be the starting 15, etc. So it's actually saying to some of those people, go, hey, look, thanks for your help, but, you know, I just got to worry about myself and go from there.
Thanks. Well, please stopping me and giving me guidelines. That would drive me mad. Did some of the players take it to heart? Because I won't name them, but there was a couple of guys that I saw post, I think, whether it was maybe when it lifting the trophy or post, but a fantastic performance you put in after a couple of losses. And they were sort of posting videos on social media, kind of almost saying, you know, you doubted us, but look what we did. And it kind of feels like you've proved the point. You subsequently won, was it seven on the bounce, right, and business as usual. Maybe not in the fashion you would want to do it, because we're used to seeing bigger performances. But it seems like it did get a little bit harder in that group for a bit.
Yeah, like people do take a lot of those comments to heart. But the one thing that for myself and majority of the team is, we're probably our own biggest criticism. You know, critics. I can't even say that word. You know what I mean? But that's just the way it is. And sometimes people are going, oh, you haven't reviewed yourself hard enough. And you're going, well, actually we have. But you can't actually say that to friends, fans, etc. But that's the thing. People do take that stuff to heart. They're allowed to. And some people use that for motivation, and that's a good thing. But if it's eroding away at confidence, eroding away at the way people were playing, then that's a different thing. And then there's ways of helping people out there. So for myself, I'm pretty easy. I'm not a big social media, and people probably don't know where I live, so I can kind of hide away a bit more if need be. But kids are a great leveler too. Like, I always remember some of the guys saying, you'll get home and the kids will run up to you. They don't care if you won by 50 or lost by 50. They just want to see you at home. So it's always nice to get away when you can.
Well, we Alex has dispelled the magic of when we were recording this, but obviously this is coming out later. But coming back off the autumns, you know, obviously England haven't played very well. We spoke to Ellis Genge, and he echoed some of your points, saying exactly the same thing that, you know, and I said, you know, it's a sport at the end of the day. You're good at your sport. It's meant to be fun. You win some, you lose some, you know, but it's not the end of the world. One thing we asked him about Eddie Jones was, you know, there's a few coaches in world rugby at the moment that are under pressure, right? And it seems to go in circular motion. You know, Ian Foster was persona non grata a while ago. The pressure's now off him. You know, the All Blacks are going into the World Cup or preparation in a good place. We asked Ellis whether, when the media are hammering you, you know, does it affect, you know, the team environment? Because yes, you don't pick up the newspapers, but it is harder with social media. In that period of time, were you a bit concerned? You know, does the pressure, because you know the top of the tree is under pressure, or do you just literally not worry about it and you all stick together and you believe in the game plan, so it's not a problem and you don't start talking in corners and everyone's joined up? Or does it seep in a bit? Because especially in the fishbowl, when everybody's saying, you know, like, and although some of those old All Blacks, some of those other people are like, get rid of him, Ian Foster's got to go, you know, you must not have been impervious to that. It must have been a bit tricky, was it? Or was it absolutely fine? You just put your crash helmet on and carried on?
Pretty much for me, I'm pretty, what's the right word, naive to a point. So I've just, for me, the way I've always felt like I've played the best is actually worrying about myself and what I can control and my role. And I could see it with some players. They were starting to get worried about everything else, and you're going, hey, look, this is what we need. This is what the team needs from you, is actually just going out and playing well. So I know that's a boring answer, but no, that's actually, you can see when we did that, we had good performances, and then all of a sudden you're going, okay, well, yeah, pressure's off a little bit, but then actually we didn't perform the way we knew we could have or the way we wanted to. And then, you know, all of a sudden that just compounds. So it is one of those things, you've just got to go, what can I control? What can I do? Go do it. And by doing that, all of a sudden, if I'm playing well, that's taking... Well, allowing my other locking partner to play well. It's allowing the loose forwards to play well. It's allowing the front row to have a good scrum. All of a sudden, you're getting penalties versus giving away penalties. So it's really simple, but I think that's something that people do forget all the time. And it's one of those things you hear through the States quite a bit, is with the NFL, and that is just do your job.
Yeah.
You might not score the winning touchdown, but you might be the guy to block to give the QB time to throw.
Worry about what you can control, fulfill your role, and just make sure your side of the street's clean. And that's basically the upshot of it. Don't judge other people. Yeah, no, I love it. I just wondered, again, I mean, look, maybe you're not the right person to ask about this, because, as I said, you deal with it in a very, the right way, the very matter-of-fact way, the same way that I deal with everything, because if I listen to everything that people say about me, I'd never leave the house.
I try not to listen to what they say about you. That depresses me as
I
well.
I don't know, Sam. We don't probably haven't listened to what we did an episode where we did all the feedback on the podcast, and basically it was, would James Haskell shut up and go away? That was basically what they said. But again, I worry about what I can control. I just wondered, for some people, do you think that the criticism of the All Blacks and the writing them off has gone and lit a fire under all of your arses, and now, you know, rue the day that you question whether the All Blacks are past it? Because I feel like they might have done that.
Beginning to become a bit nasty again. There's a bit coming back.
I think that might happen, but you might not. Because you might not have been engaged in it. But do you think there's a bit of that maybe?
Oh, I think for some people, yeah, 100%. You know, they take some of that stuff to heart. I know for myself, some of the worst people to talk to when we're not playing well, whether that's personally or as a team, is probably family, because they are a little bit more direct than most. They're not worried about pulling their words.
Having four All Black brothers can't help as well.
Oh, no, I'm talking about my aunties and uncles.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Like, you had a shocker. You know, kids are the same. Like, Dad, you dropped the ball. And like, oh, yeah, I'm worried about that. But I think with all of it is, I'd be concerned if the team was taking a lot of that as motivation, because where we see ourselves and ourselves as caretakers of the legacy is that pressure is always there for us. So whether we win by, you know, 5 points, the way we should be looking at our game, how we're evolving and growing, that should be there. We don't need people to tell us. And that's something that we're lucky, because we've got this amazing history over 100 years of it, of people that have put the team before themselves. So that's something that we've got to just keep driving as ourselves now, as current members. And it's good that our fans are so passionate around what we say and what we do and how we perform, what our results are, because they are the team, and they are the kids coming up that will take us out, take this team, you know, when they do get that opportunity.
Can I ask, I'm conscious we're eating into your summer holiday, so we must let you go as quickly as we possibly can. Can I just ask you a couple of questions to finish up with? The All Black captaincy, how great an honour, how great a responsibility, how does that sit on your very broad shoulders?
Yeah, it's something that you never, growing up, you know, like I said, I don't even think I was going to play professional rugby, let alone be lucky enough to play for the All Blacks and be asked to skip the side on a number of occasions. But at the same time, it's never just you. There's always other people there to help. And, you know, there's no point me talking around back attack. I've got no idea what's going on. I wouldn't even know half the moves, what they're called. So you let the teams do that. You let the midfielders and the loose forwards talk around the defence. So for yourself, you know, obviously I'm dealing with the line-out, and that's the area that I'm driving. And then the reality is you're just trying to sum it all up. And the easiest way to do it, and this is what was passed on from Richie, from Kieran, from Kevy, DC, all those guys that I was lucky enough to play with, is go out there and play well. If you play well, all of a sudden you lead well and everything else becomes easy. There's nothing worse than, you know, your captain going, oh, guys, you've got to make your tackle. And you're like, hang on, you've just missed the last three, and that's why they scored three tries. So it comes down to playing well, and then everything else kind of flows, and talking to the referee, all those things, it's easy when you're actually putting your best foot forward.
When you look at 2022, how much better a state, I'm going to say bar the last 8 minutes as you referenced, but how much better a place are the All Blacks in coming out of 2022 than perhaps they were going into that Ireland series?
Yeah, we didn't play that well at the start of the year, did we? No, we're definitely in a better spot. And I think the reality with that is there's probably a little bit more edge driven from the players. Management are definitely helping with that too. So it's something, no matter what team you play for, it's, you know, is your effort there, is your physicality there, everything else comes after that. You know, if the effort's not there, yeah, you might get the result in a few games, but it all comes down to that, and that's your foundation. If you don't have that, that's the thing you've got to go sort out, and then everything else flows.
Good on you. I think the rest of the world will certainly be sitting up and taking great notice of how you finished in those last few games. We've got some quick fire questions I'd like to finish with, but the final thing, just as part of the interview, I wanted to ask you about was the incredible photograph, and you know where I'm going with this, taken with you and John Key in the aftermath of 2015. Have you turned that into a Christmas card? Is that framed and hung above your bed? I mean, it looks like something out of... I'm going to pass that on to Hass just so you can reference it. You know the one? Have you ever seen that before?
No, I haven't.
I mean, that is Unbelievable, isn't it? Is John Key really that small in real life, or is that just a trick of the camera?
No, it's one of those things. Some people come up to you, they normally had a few drinks after a game. They're like, oh, can we do the John Key photo? Like, how do you do it? And it's actually really easy. Obviously, being tall, John Key, he's not a tiny guy, but like he's normal-ish, we'll say. But he was in my seat where I was getting changed, and I was like, oh, how do I kind of – I was knackered after the game. I was kind of wanting to get out so then I could sit down and collect my breath. And I was like, oh, okay, how am I going to do this? And I'm just like, oh, hey, how you going? You know, shook his hand. But the photographer in the room had a fish lens on at the time. I've only learned this after, which makes anything closer to the camera look way bigger. And because I've shaken his hand, my big backside, and that's right there next to him, and he's kind of away a little bit, so it just made me look even bigger. So like my hand, I think shaking, it looks like it's bigger than his whole head. But there's no way that my hand's that big. Like, I'm a big person, but I'm not a giant. But yeah, it's what it is. And so I got married in that summer, and the photographer straight away goes, right, we'll do the photo. And we're like, what do you mean? You've just done photos for ages. And he's like, oh no, we'll do the John Key. So he got, you know, me to be there and my wife, who's short already, so I was even massive. And then he's like, right, we'll switch it around now. So he made her look real tall, and I was like the little one out the back. So we had a bit of fun with it since that photo.
That's the kind of picture that destroys political careers. I don't know, did John Key ever get re-elected off the back of that?
Or I've
did
never you diminish seen the pipes, the arms on the man as well.
It looks
well.
Like something out of The Hobbit,
it
doesn't
does, it? It does.
It's like Hagrid in The Hobbit.
It
Hobbit.
Is.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's. I've had all those comparisons, like Ryan Crotty and that. When I was younger, they used to call me Gandhi for Gandalf. So when that photo came out, you imagine what all the boys were like. They were just into me. So yeah,
that's a framer. That should be on the front cover of the book.
We're going to now get a fish. You know, we're going to steal this idea and run it with Good Bad Rugby. We've got a fantastic social media guy called Craig. And he's now online on Amazon ordering fisheye lenses for everything.
Every guest that comes in.
We're
going to
mug off
photo.
Everyone we meet.
Should we do the quick fire questions?
Yeah, I was going to ask just quickly, right? You got former teammates. You talked about them, right? Can you just give us a sentence about each of these guys, just quickly? So, Richie McCaw.
Oh, he was the annoying guy that was out warming up before you'd even got off the bus. So, just highly, highly driven.
Kieran Reid.
Very, very smart player. Not the fittest man, but very rugby fit.
Dan Carter.
The greatest.
Oi, you almost like said it, but like, oh, God, he's so fit and he's the greatest as well. I think that every time I see him, I'm like, God, you got everything. I hope he's got a small willy. That's all I hate. That's all I care about. Sonny Bill Williams.
Yeah, Sonny was awesome for myself. Played or started our first test match together.
Amazing. Mal Nonu.
Competitive as and drove a lot of things on and off the field.
Conrad Smith.
Very, very intelligent. One quick story about Conrad is I remember he did his PB bench in his last gym session. I think it was 107 kg, so just smart and clever, but yet again, put in big shots, but not a real strong man.
No, not 107. That's
my kind of weight, I think.
You couldn't lift 107.
Don't worry about
that. I reckon that's something you could do, maybe get him to do 107 kg on the show, you know? I'm sure people would love to see that.
Yeah, I'm old, I'm retired.
We could build you up. We could build
you
up.
Do you want to do that?
Yeah, we'll build you up. Remember what you said, your shields to life, because you're a weed. Like, right. You're like Sam was back in the day. Like, you've got no shields, you've got no defences.
I've had a fight you haven't.
Yeah, fine. You're right, tough guy.
Listen. You do a lot of training, a lot of chat. I get in the ring and deliver.
One of the All Blacks' greatest ever players has said, you need shields and defences. Right, okay. You're nothing, you're defenceless.
Thanks for the help, Sam, I appreciate it. Kevin Malamu.
Oh, the guy that was the nicest guy on the field, but the hardest guy to play against.
Really? And last but not least, Tony Woodcock.
Loves a beer, but just was awesome for a young guy coming up. He used to say to me, you know, click on and I'll pull you through the scrum. So, yeah, no, he was a good man.
Like a horse and cart. Do you know, I had Tony Woodcock, first try scorer, 66-1, £10 on in the 2009 World Cup final.
Did you?
When did you plan that move, out of interest? Was that one that you had in the locker for years or that week?
Yeah, Woody had scored heaps of tries off it early on. You know, like I'm talking, you know, 05, 07. And it was always pulled out every now and again. But we'd practice it the whole week and about that try. So Woody scored. I'm so excited. And myself, Thorny, there's about three or four of us, Rita, I think, all and Rico all kind of got there at the same time. But I've actually tripped up on my sprigs and I've kind of landed on top of them. But luckily, I was so excited, I've kind of bounced up straight away. So it was kind of like the worst moment. So happy. And then I've kind of like tripped, landed on them and gone, oh no. And then, but luckily, I've bounced up and everyone's jumped up. So I kind of got away with the worst uncoordinated thing. I was 21 sprigs in the ground and sniped from a distance.
Size 13 boots, tripping over yourself. And imagine you injured him. We'd never live that day. Tripping, falling, yeah. Injure him and be out of the mix.
Shall we? Right, Sam, last but not least, are you happy to just fire through some quick fire questions? Should we alternate?
Yes.
Right, you go first.
A childhood hero.
Norm Maxwell.
Good shout. Best player you've played with?
Oh, any of those guys you just said.
You got a name and shame, pal.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I'm just trying to be political here to a point. Actually, David Pocock was a guy I played in Japan with. It wasn't until you got to play with him you realised how good he was.
Good answer.
Best player played against?
I was lucky enough to play against Victor and Bucky's early in my career, so I'll put them as a combo.
That's a gnarly combo as well.
That's a gnarly combo. Best coach?
Wayne Smith. Tough.
Favourite stadium?
Love Eden Park at home, but love playing in Wales, just the history there.
Everyone says Principality. Best atmosphere that you've played in? Best game for the atmosphere?
We played in Soweto in 2010. Israel Deggs scored in the last play of the game. It was after the Soccer World Cup and they had those, what are those horns called?
The Vuvuzelas.
100,000 people there. Yeah, couldn't hear anything. Absolutely deafing myself the whole time. I caught a kickoff and almost got tackled out. The game would have been over, and Kevin Mialamu saved me again. So
I remember that's when Marn Nonu's boot came off, didn't it? As he made the bust.
Yeah, I can't remember if I was inside or outside him, and I was like, "Carry, mate," because I'm not going to do anything here. I remember John Smith was left there with his boot in his 100th game, being like, "Why has this happened?"
So, I remember that.
Funniest person in rugby.
Do I have to say you or what?
No, you don't.
Contractually obliged.
You know, yeah.
It does say, please say me in brackets.
So besides yourself, Johnny Arfoa is a guy that, he just makes me laugh, man. He's a good, good man. Richie Mwang is another one that's up there. His parents taking the mickey out of the coaches the whole time, presenting, the game plan. He's just doing all the mannerisms and the guys are like giggling away, but the coach has got no idea what's going on.
Trade secrets revealed. Watch your back, Richie. Favourite band?
Foo Fighters.
Really? Any history with them?
Yeah, so Rita and I got to meet them when they were here in Christchurch. And it was funny because they were kind of in the normal promo mode. Hey, guys, rock and roll, photo. And then the security would be like, next. And we kind of were in the line. And they kind of did that at the start. And then the security guy is kind of leant over and going, oh, these guys are the All Blacks. And then it was like they changed. Dave Grohl's like, oh, you guys are fucking crazy. And was explaining around the haka and all this stuff. And all the band were there and the security guys like, your time's up. And they're like, nah, it's sweet. And we kind of talked to them for maybe, 10 minutes where I think initially we kind of had a 2-minute slot. So it was real cool to just have a photo with them, get to talk to them real quickly. And the concert was awesome too. So yeah, it was pretty cool getting to meet them.
The treat of being an All Black, eh?
I laugh, he tripped up when he still had his boots on and went straight through Dave Grohl.
Straight through the drum kit.
Yeah, probably.
Have you got hidden talent we don't know about?
Can't sing. Can't dance, so no, probably not.
Okay,
very good in the lineup though.
Probably basketball, yeah. Probably basketball is the thing.
Best life hack?
Marry a good wife.
Very wise. Thank you. Right. He's back. In the mix. Back. He's got it right. Yeah.
She's actually just off screen.
Something your teammates don't know about you.
I can knit.
What?
Learned how to knit. Yeah. So, mum. Love knitting, and then all four of us boys, she didn't have a daughter, so she made all of us learn how to knit when we were little. And that's one of the things that a lot of the boys probably don't know.
I honestly, of all the things,
we've destroyed some reputations in our time, but that's the greatest.
My wife, I'm in the office at the moment, my wife's trying to learn and I'm trying to teach her, but she's terrible. So
she's actually just produced wool for our audio listeners. He's produced knitting needles and wool.
My wife's got it. I don't know if the needles are there, but
Being a Kiwi.
She was trying to learn for a while, but then we had kids, so it's got a bit of dust on
it. What have you knitted? What's your greatest piece of knitwear?
I knitted a scarf once, I think, but it's, about this long, so. Yeah.
Scarf for
More of a flannel.
No, Sharp for K. Well, no, for what's his name? The bloke in the photo.
John Key.
Little scarf for him.
He's bigger than this.
Oh, is he? His little neck, though, will be fine. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that little scarf will fit around that little twiglet of a neck. You'll be all right.
All right, thank you.
He's got a neck.
Yeah,
like
now,
a...
once he gets his bench press out, he'll be all right.
Oh, yeah, perfect. I'll get bulky.
Just on the knitting thing, it's funny you should say that. I actually sat on a train the other day and I saw this woman knitting. It looked quite therapeutic, and I genuinely thought, I wonder if I could shouldn't have a go at that.
I think you've got many ills to solve, but I'm not sure that knitting is going to go that far in getting them corrected.
Knit myself a defensive shield.
last but not least, best nickname in rugby. Have you got good the nicknames? Beast. The Beast. The Beast is good.
Yeah, The Beast, just, I think, Bull Allen used to have a good one too, you know, Bull. Yeah. And everyone just used to do the same as The Beast, really. So it's kind of gone around the world. Different people have that same kind of vibe around it, but yeah.
I love
The Detonator was quite cool too for the Black Ferns. You know, that's, I'd love to have that because he just obviously goes off and changes the game pretty quickly.
I was going to ask you about that. Just tell us about, now you're back, I can't imagine you haven't unpacked yet, but just the impact of that Black Ferns win.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was one thing that sucked is because we were away the whole time. So we caught up with the girls, captain's run before their last warm-up game before Japan. And, you know, went to school with Sarah Goss at that stage, but Hanani now. So know each other really well. But then there's a lot of crossover with a lot of the girls through, you know, growing up in the same areas, same schools. So a lot of the team do know the Black Ferns pretty well. But what they did and what they achieved going from where they were, what was it, 10 months ago, couldn't win a line out, getting pumped by 30 and 40 from the English and the French, to going out there and getting the job done, the biggest occasion at home, sellout crowd, you know, how awesome, how cool. And it was so cool to see Rue get the Women's Player of the Year at the awards. It was well deserved and pretty awesome seeing a 10 just control the game, control the team and get the job done.
And you mentioned Wayne Smith as well as the professor who was coach of the year as well. I mean, it was a remarkable turnaround. An inspiration for you, I imagine, heading to next year as well. Are you feeling good? Are you feeling ready? Are you got another big lap in front of you?
Yeah, I'm enjoying not training at the moment, to tell you the truth, but give it a week or two and I'll get that itch back straight away. And I've got a few messages coming through now from the trainers and stuff saying, send us your plan, but we'll just let them be on ice for a couple of days and deal with it then.
Send them a picture of the wool and a middle finger.
That's a good one. Hey, you guys are going to dine out on that.
I am, mate.
We are. We've trashed it. Yeah. Do you know, Sam, it's been really, really enjoyable. I'm hugely grateful to you. We are hugely grateful to you for dialing in, particularly on your summer holidays. But it's been lovely to chat. And all I think we can say is that we wish you the very best of luck for what is to come over the next 10, 12 months or so. It's going to be fascinating to watch. It's an absolute bum fight out there, but it's very good to see the All Blacks back doing what they should be doing. So good on you. Thank you so much for joining us. Enjoy your summer holidays, and we'll look forward to catching up on the other side.
Awesome. Cheers, guys, and thanks for having us on.
Thanks, mate.
Well, there he goes. What a man. What amazing rugby stock he's from. Fingers crossed for one last dance at the World Cup next year for the great Sam Whitelock. And what a year, of course, it's going to be for all of us and for rugby. As 2023 comes into play, we have got another pair of heavyweights to open our account this year. Bill Sweeney and Simon Massey-Taylor, the CEOs of the RFU and Prem Rugby, respectively, will be on next week's show. But this has been The Good, The Bad and The Rugby, produced by Shara Kilgallen and Ollie Hunter. It's a Folding Pocket production. We will see you next week. Look after yourselves in the meantime. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Good, yay, The Bad, and The Rugby, oof, with Alex Payne, James Haskell and Mike Tyndall. Thanks for listening.
Because you're a weed. I can't get over the fact I'm a massive gobshite.